This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, September 15th. I'm Randy Zimmerman from Pacifica affiliate WMNF in Tampa. Thousands support striking Yale workers. Activists in New York rally for reparations. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals has postponed California's October 7 recall election. Kelly O'Ramirez is in Berkeley.
Siding with the American Civil Liberties Union, the federal court said that punch card balloting was error-prone and could undermine voters' confidence in the results. The six counties, including Los Angeles and San Diego, that were scheduled to use punch cards for the recall are already under a separate court order to replace their voting systems by the March 2004 primary. Holding the recall together with the primary is considered an advantage for the Democrats because a higher voter turnout is expected. Today's ruling applies to both the recall and two unrelated ballot measures scheduled for October 7th. The court delayed its ruling for a week to allow an appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. For FSRN, I'm Kelly Ramirez in Berkeley, California.
Venezuela's election council has rejected a petition calling for a referendum on ending Hugo Chavez's presidency. Greg Wilpert has more from Caracas.
The council ruled that the petition was invalid because the signatures were collected 6 months before the right to a recall referendum became effective. That is, according to Venezuela's constitution, the right to a recall referendum becomes a reality only once the president has completed half of his term in office. This halfway point, however, was only reached in August, well after the recall petition signatures were collected. The opposition has now promised to organize another petition drive, scheduled for late September to early October, which, if successful, means that the presidential recall referendum would take place sometime early next year. Greg Wilpert reporting for Free Speech Radio News from Caracas, Venezuela.
The U.S. Senate begins debate today about whether to fund research on creating usable nuclear weapons. Mitch Jeserich reports from the nation's capital.
As written, the 2004 Energy and Appropriation Bill in Congress repeals the Spratt First Amendment that prohibits the development of low-yield nuclear weapons. The bill also funds nuclear weapons programs, including research on bunker bombs and the renovation of a Nevada test site so to resume underground nuclear tests. Democratic Senators Dianne Feinstein of California and Ted Kennedy of Massachusetts have introduced an amendment to block funding for these programs. Democratic Senator Byron Dorgan, representing North Dakota, also supports the amendments.
I think this is horribly dangerous for this country. What kind of a signal do we send as a country to other countries that have nuclear weapons that nuclear weapons are usable?
Though the majority of the Senate Democrats oppose increasing nuclear weapons research, two Democratic senators, Ben Nelson of Nebraska and Evan Bayh of Indiana, have previously voted in favor of funding research for these programs. With Republican support, the measure is expected to pass the Senate sometime this week. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Mitch Jeserich in Washington.
An internal EPA document says current soot emission standards do not adequately protect public health and should be tightened. In Washington, D.C., Ellen Ratner.
An internal Environmental Protection Agency document suggests that current standards on the amount of soot in the air do not effectively protect people with elderly or respiratory problems. This document said that there is an increased correlation between exposure to soot, premature death, cardiovascular, and respiratory problems. These findings could serve as the foundation for further restrictions on soot emitted by cars, trucks, power plants, and factories. However, the Bush administration claims that the current standards issued by the Clinton White House are based on questionable science. They say the rules have cost industries billions of dollars and should be relaxed. If adopted, the internal EPA document would pit the Bush administration against business groups. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Ellen Ratner.
The United Auto Workers reached a tentative agreement on a four-year contract with Daimler Chrysler early this morning. The breakthrough came just hours after the union's previous contract with the carmaker expired. Workers' Independent News Service correspondent John Hamilton.
The United Auto Workers is keeping quiet on details of the four-year deal, saying nothing about how the tentative contract would affect such issues as plant closures, pensions, and health care. UAW President Ron Gettelfinger would say only that the agreement with Daimler Chrysler sets the framework for similar agreements with other U.S. auto producers and their parts suppliers.
Our bargaining committees at General Motors and Delphi, at Ford and Visteon will continue to negotiate. They will stay at the bargaining table until a tentative agreement is hammered out with those companies.
Gettelfinger has promised to hold the line on medical benefits as automakers seek to shift rising health costs onto workers. Meanwhile, pensions are playing an important role in the talks. According to the credit rating agency Fitch Ratings, U.S. auto-related industries ended the 2002 fiscal year with pension plans underfunded by more than a collective $30 billion. With the Workers Independent News Service, I'm John Hamilton for Free Speech Radio News.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nell Abram.
India joined Malaysia in rejecting the revised draft of the Cancun Ministerial Declaration, charging that the WTO is not only deliberately neglecting their concerns, but comfort is being given to developed countries, which provide huge trade-distorting subsidies. Meanwhile, many activists and delegates of non-governmental organizations, or NGOs, celebrated the collapse of the talks as a triumph for developing nations, which proved their increased negotiating power. Led by India, Brazil, and China, the so-called G21 group of developing countries collectively rejected the draft ministerial declaration, which top U.S. Trade Representative Robert Zolnick dismissed as countries going for freebies. Zolnick said that the U.S. was bending over backwards to help poor countries, with the G21 rejecting every attempt. Dan Jaffe wraps up the failed ministerial talks and the action on the streets from Cancun.
Agricultural subsidies were the most divisive issue here at the Cancun Ministerial, and they demonstrate the profound split between the positions of the industrialized nations and the global south. What is new in Cancun, however, is the emergence of a potent new force to challenge the U.S. and European Union, especially since China joined the WTO in 2001. The G23 group of countries, which includes China, India, and Brazil, and represents over half of humanity, as well as 85% of the world's farmers, is demanding that the U.S. and EU fulfill their earlier promises and eliminate all agricultural export subsidies. Dr. Sigfredo Serrano is the chief trade negotiator on agriculture for the Philippines, a member of the G23.
What the United States is saying is that, okay, open your markets first before we even think about reducing our subsidies. Now, those subsidies are killing the livelihoods of our farmers in the Philippines, and essentially, especially export subsidies of the Europeans, is feeding on the blood of my people.
Corporate lobbyists and representatives also have a significant presence here in Cancun, and according to many observers, they've played a major role in forming and reinforcing the bargaining positions of the U.S. and the European Union. Pascal Kernes, managing director of the European Services Forum, which represents all European service industries, rejects the long-standing demands by civil society groups to tie trade liberalization to environmental, labor, and social standards.
This is world trade. This is globalization. Either you close your market, you protect your market, you have your own consumers, and you're happy with that, or you want to play with the others. But we feel that there is already so many difficulties to achieve something in this World Trade Organization with agriculture, tariffs, and services, and possibly other issues. If we have to add social labors and environment, it's going to be much more difficult.
While the negotiators have been meeting at the Cancun Convention Center, security outside the building has been extremely tight. The direct route to Cancun's hotel zone from the city center has been closed since Tuesday, forcing workers as well as some press and delegates to take a 25-mile detour. In downtown Cancun, outside the security gates, a wide variety of indigenous, peasant, and civil society groups from Mexico and around the world held large demonstrations. Brenda Latofa from South Africa says the WTO's policies tie the hands of national governments and prevent them from protecting the public interest.
We don't believe in the World Trade Organization. We want the World Trade Organization to be derailed because it says takes away our human rights. Our basic services are being sold at a profit. The agreements within the World Trade Organization are trading away our rights, our social rights, our food rights, our government sovereignty to regulate within their countries. And have a negative impact on us as women, because when the states fails us, it is us women who have to take the burden of the states.
Not all activists were behind the security fences. Many members of non-governmental and activist groups have been accredited by the WTO to enter the meeting site to lobby delegates and speak to the press. These organizations held several loud demonstrations throughout the week, which drew instant attention from the more than 1,200 journalists in the convention center. The resistance of the G23 on agriculture, the lack of movement on other issues such as services and investment, and southern nations increasingly emboldened by their newfound strength all conspired to scuttle any meaningful agreements. And that, according to Walden Bellow, director of the Southeast Asia-based group Focus on the Global South, is good news for poor nations and their people.
Well, the most favorable outcome for the developing world is a derailed ministerial, in which there are no new initiatives at liberalization that are agreed upon, including agriculture and subsidies, because no agreement is better than a bad agreement.
The impact of the failure of the WTO talks may not be fully visible for several months or more. Yet as the fifth WTO ministerial meeting ends in collapse, there is a tangible sense here that the newfound strength of a large bloc of southern nations has shifted the balance of power between rich and poor countries, at least on the terrain of trade and economic policy. Reporting from Cancun, Mexico, this is Dan Jaffe for Free Speech Radio News.
A high school teacher and poetry team coach who was fired at the start of the U.S. bombing in Iraq takes his case to court today. Teacher Bill Nevin says he lost his position at Rio Rancho High School in New Mexico when one of his students read a poem criticizing war fervor to the student body. As Joe Gardner-Wesley reports, the poetic community of New Mexico is rallying around him while his legal team is readying its case.
More than 30 musicians and poets took to a downtown Albuquerque stage last night in support of humanities teacher Bill Nevins.
I gotta get fired more often, man.
Nevins was a humanities teacher and coached a poetry slam team called Write Club, named after the movie Fight Club. He alleges that after a student of his read a poem called Revolution X over the school's PA system in February, administrators at Rio Rancho High suspended him and did not renew his teaching contract. Without its sponsor, the club was disbanded.
I was suddenly suspended from my teaching position and my role as the poetry team coach and Write Club sponsor on March 17th. Maybe a coincidence, but it was certainly ironic that on the day that it was declared there was going to be an attack on Iraq, the poetry team was shut down at Rio Rancho High School.
We are part of a movement that will not follow like sheep.
Attorney Eric Sorotkin of the National Lawyers Guild will represent Nevins in court.
We are here to take our schools back, to take our country back, to take our dignity back.
Sorotkin explains their strategy.
We're hoping to get the poetry team reestablished. We're hoping to get Mr. Nevins back working with the poetry team. And we're hoping to get him back to work in a school there. However, we're also looking at possible damages or punitive damages if they won't come along that will help to deter future conduct.
And one day, a student read a poem across the school's closed-circuit TV. This poem angered the school's military liaison. The administration took up the banner. They began to hunt for the poem.
That's not accurate.
Larry Morrell is military liaison and guidance counselor for Rio Rancho High School.
My response to the poem that was or the PA system, I emailed the principal. And this is about the time we were just about ready to invade Iraq, I think it was. And I said, I think there needs to be a policy on this. I never, ever used a name. I didn't know who had done it. I didn't even know who the student was. I just said, I think there needs to be a policy on this, so if this is going to happen again, we've got some guidelines.
Rio Rancho Public School administrators will not comment on the suit, saying only that it is a personnel matter and not a free speech issue. On the day FSRN visited the campus, the morning announcements were broadcast to the school. It was during this time in February when the poem Revolution X was read. On this day, announcements featured the Pledge of Allegiance, news of a fundraiser for the Junior ROTC, and for See You at the Poll, a national event to, quote, pray for the leaders of our nation around high school flagpoles.
I think after the whole issue with Mr. Nevins, it's a little more closed and people are more afraid to speak their minds.
Bethany Spencer was secretary for Write Club before it was disbanded. At last night's performance, she said she has been unable to restart a literary club this year.
I think that's ridiculous, and I tried a little bit to get it restarted again, but they either won't let us or no teachers want to, so.
Nevins presents his lawsuit in court today. In the meantime, he has been hired at a school in Albuquerque's South Valley to teach journalism. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Joe Gardner-Wesley in Albuquerque.
On Saturday, thousands of workers from Boston, Philadelphia, New York, and other cities around the Northeast converged on New Haven, Connecticut. They came for a massive rally in support of striking Yale workers who were members of HERE, the Hotel Employees and Restaurant Employees International Union. They're in the third week of strike for higher pay, better job security, and especially decent pensions. At a march following the rally on the New Haven Green, 130 people were arrested for civil disobedience, including AFL-CIO President John Sweeney. Melinda Tuhus reports from New Haven, Connecticut.
Textile workers, carpenters, service workers, and other union members greeted each other as they lunched on 1,200 pizzas, for which the city is famous. A large percentage of the visiting unionists were Latino, whose favorite chant is Si se puede, or Yes, it can be done.
Si se puede, si se puede.
At a news conference before the rally, Sweeney and three international union presidents explained why they came to Yale. Andy Stern is president of the 2-million-strong Service Employees International Union, which is trying to win representation at Yale's affiliated hospital. He said the Yale strike is the defining labor struggle of this decade.
In the sense that we have a prestigious university with huge amounts of resources who continue to act in a way to its hospital workers and university workers that just aren't right for an institution that calls itself a center of excellence. We think Yale's a center of arrogance and a center of irresponsibility, and most importantly, we intend to spread this strike throughout the country. There is no trustee who is safe anywhere anymore. They need to take responsibility for Yale and the behavior of this institution and its hospital.
Bruce Rayner, president of UNITE, the Union of Needle Trades, Industrial, and Textile Employees, brought 1,000 of his red T-shirted members to the rally.
This demonstration, the appearance of national labor leaders at a particular strike, is extremely unusual. And what this is about is it's about Yale. This is a university that has historically the worst labor relations of any university in America.
Yale's unionized workforce, representing 1,100 dining hall, custodial, and maintenance workers and almost 3,000 clerical and technical workers, walked out August 27th after working 19 months without a contract. It was clear from day one of the strike that pensions are the top issue. The unions say the average payment for those with 20 or more years of service is $621 a month. The administration responds that after 30 years at Yale and adding in Social Security payments, most employees can retire on 83 to 93% of their full salaries. The unions counter that those numbers apply to a mythical worker, one who requests no survivor benefits, one who has paid into Social Security from the age of 18, and one who has contributed to his or her own retirement plan. Such workers, union officials say, are almost non-existent. At the rally, HERE President John Wilhelm, who got his start in the labor movement at Yale, gave an update on negotiations.
For the first time, because of the tremendous solidarity that all of you are showing, we actually made a little bit of progress.
Yeah!
Keep up the pressure and we'll get there.
Yeah!
After the rally, union members, students, and community residents filed into the street for a march around the campus. At one intersection, two consecutive groups of marchers sat down in the street and were arrested by police. All told, 130 people were charged with disorderly conduct, including all the national labor leaders and the presidents of Yale's two locals. A spokesman for the Yale administration dismissed the rally as a publicity stunt. He said the unions should focus their energies on the 50% of clerical and technical workers who are crossing picket lines to go to work. More than 90% of the maintenance and dining hall workers are on strike. He says the administration has a generous offer on the table that includes annual raises as well as full payment of family health insurance, several weeks of paid time off, and help with college tuition and buying a home in certain New Haven neighborhoods. Those who participated were satisfied that they had sent a strong message about labor solidarity. Jerry Ford is a member of the Cafeteria Workers Union in Philadelphia, part of HERE. She currently makes $8.01 an hour. Yale workers, after 9 strikes in the past 40 years, averaged twice that.
We came down to support the Yale strikers who are in the same plight that we are. We're in negotiations at this moment. So we might be calling on this crew to come on down to Philadelphia and help us out.
Negotiations are continuing. For FSRN, I'm Melinda Tuhus in New Haven, Connecticut.
On Saturday, despite the threat of rain and a plethora of other activities taking place in New York City, reparations activists from all over the country gathered at Dag Hammarskjöld Plaza at the United Nations to press home the case for reparations to people of African descent. Reporting on that activity is Free Speech Radio News correspondent Ian Forrest from WBAI in New York.
In an ongoing campaign calling for reparations for people of African descent for the internationally recognized crime of slavery, Millions for Reparations, the umbrella unit for a number of organizations seeking restitution, took its campaign to the United Nations this past weekend.
What time is it? What time is it?
Coltrane Shimaranga of the December 12 movement. Veteran civil rights activist and pastor of the House of the Lord Church in Brooklyn, Herbert Daughtry.
Jesus, you notice, didn't try to organize the masses. What he did is very carefully selected people who he knew would carry the message and carry on. And so that's the way great movements are really built. You get committed people together and begin to build trust factors, and you grow and you grow and you build a foundation. So as I said, we'd love to have the place running over out here. But this crowd may be the crowd that can turn this thing around.
Roger Wareham is an attorney representing plaintiffs in a class action lawsuit filed last year seeking reparations from prominent companies on the current corporate landscape identified as beneficiaries from the institution of slavery. Among some 19 companies so identified, Wareham and his team of attorneys have narrowed the campaign to focus on insurance giant Aetna, whose records show that it maintained insurance policies on the lives of enslaved Africans.
Slave owners insured the lives of enslaved Africans so they could always make sure they had a profit. So Aetna, which is also U.S. healthcare, we're collecting the names of 100,000 people who have Aetna policies and submit them to Aetna and let them know that it really would be in their interest to work this out. So if you have Aetna, if you know anybody who has Aetna, you need to come and give your names to the people. We got cards we want people to fill out. That's going to be part of the campaign.
Another attorney on the team, Lionel Jean-Baptiste, highlighted other struggles taking place around the world for reparations, pointing in particular to the Haitian effort to get back the $150 million they were forced to pay France in 1825 for the freedom which they fought for and won some 200 years ago.
Today, the Haitian people are demanding that money back, and they have calculated the money at present value to be $21,685,135,571.48. And it's climbing every day that they don't pay it. The Haitians in New York are holding a rally on September 19, 2003. They're asking France to pay back the money that were taken from them in 1825. And the money will be used for schools, hospital, electricity, roads, water.
Ina Daniels Hurdle McGee, a plaintiff in the lawsuit who flew from Dallas, Texas to be at the New York rally, has relatives who were the biological children of slaves. She is confident that reparations will come.
We're looking forward to winning. We're going to win this fight. I believe in reparations. We deserve it. Everyone else has gotten reparations, so why not us?
As the fight for African reparations continue, activists will be taking the case to the Hill in October to persuade their representatives to sign on to H.R. 40, the study bill on reparations sponsored by Democrat John Conyers. Reporting for FSRN in New York, I am Ian Forrest.
One of the most contentious issues being discussed at the World Trade Organization meeting in Cancun, Mexico, and the reason given for the breakdown of the talks, is agricultural subsidies to farmers in rich countries. Agriculture subsidies, say poor countries, puts their farmers at a disadvantage. One key commodity is cotton. United States subsidies to American cotton farmers has substantially brought down cotton prices, creating hardship for 10 million peasant farmers in West and Central Africa. Sam Olakoya has been looking at the effects of the U.S. cotton subsidies on African farmers.
In the village of Kankara in northern Nigeria, Shuaibu Ado works on his cotton farm. He says he has not made any profit in the last years from the farm.
You see, last season when we planted cotton, there was no profit. There is no profit planting cotton. We sold cheaply. Despite the effort we put into planting, cotton farmers never received their money.
The situation is not restricted to the cotton farmers of northern Nigeria. 10 million peasant cotton farmers in West and Central Africa depend on cotton for their livelihood. They are feeling the pinch of low cotton prices. The bulk of the affected farmers are from the West African states of Benin, Chad, Burkina Faso, Mali, and Nigeria. This farmer from Burkina Faso says in the last few years, cotton prices have fallen substantially. The Nigerian farmer, Shuaibu Ado, says the low cotton prices have made it nearly impossible to survive.
There is a lot of hardship because there is no money. You want to take care of yourself, but you can't. You're compelled to accept your fate because there's nothing you can do. What can you do when you don't have money? We're selling cotton cheaply. That is the agony of us peasant farmers. We work for money that never comes.
In a country like Mali, where a third of the population depends on cotton, the entire country is affected by low cotton prices. This is the general situation for African cotton farmers. They don't receive any subsidy. But in contrast, cotton farmers in the United States receive substantial subsidies. Last year alone, U.S. farmers garnered $4 billion from the government. The World Bank says such subsidies have brought down cotton prices because American farmers have been encouraged to overgrow cotton and flood the market. In the last 2 years, cotton prices have been at an all-time low. Malam Marimadu from northern Nigeria had to quit farming cotton because of the low prices. Free Speech Radio News asked him if farmers in the area get any subsidy for growing cotton.
No, the answer is absolutely no. No subsidy.
West African delegates at the World Trade Organization meeting teamed up to put pressure on the United States to remove the cotton subsidies. Anti-globalization campaigner Bode Olufemi says the United States has to remove cotton subsidies to eliminate the unfair advantage American cotton farmers have over their African counterparts.
What we are saying is this: when you put in place subsidy on cotton, you are putting the lives of several millions of African farmers at stake. These are people whose products cannot access the international market because the U.S. government is subsidizing 25,000 farmers. And we're saying, look, you have to be fair to all. Don't play politics with the lives of our people. Remove subsidy, make our agricultural product attractive to markets elsewhere outside the African continent so that Africa can on its own develop Africa.
With 10 million cotton farmers in West and Central Africa, cotton farming is one of the most important sources of livelihood in the region. Bode Olufemi says the future of the industry and the 10 million farmers depend on whether or not the United States agrees to remove cotton subsidy. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in Lagos, Nigeria.
Today's producer for Free Speech Radio News has been Kata Mester. Our engineer is Jade Paget-Seekins. Technical assistance by Pauline Bartolone. I'm Randy Zimmerman.